Hello, everybody. Just a note on this episode before we get started. Because of unexpected difficulties with the recording, Timothy Liu's introduction got cut off, so we had to record it separately. And you'll notice a skip in the sound quality between my recording at home and the recording we did via Zoom. All right, I hope you enjoy. Timothy Liu, or Liu Timo, was born in 1965 in San Jose, California, to immigrant parents from mainland China. He's the author of 12 books of poems, including Of Thee I Sing, selected by Publishers Weekly as a 2004 Book of the Year, Say Goodnight, a 1998 Penn Open Book Margins Award, and Vox Angelica, which won the 1992 Poetry Society of America's Norma Farber First Book Award. He also edited Word of Mouth, an anthology of gay American poetry, and his next book, Down Low and Low Down, Bedside Bottom Feeder Blues, will be out in 2023. Translated into 10 languages, Liu's poems have appeared in such places as Best American Poetry, Bomb, Kenyon Review, The Nation, Paris Review, Plowshares, Poetry, the Pushcart Prize, Virginia Quarterly Review, and the Yale Review. His journals and papers are archived in the Berg Collection at the New York Public Library. He is currently a professor of English at SUNY New Paltz. And Liu is an intuitive reader of occult esoterica, including the Tarot and the I Ching and the Akashic Records, and is available for private consultations. I really admire Tim's dynamism and rigor as a thinker and artist, and the unsurpassed skill he has in writing the transgression the moment requires.
Hey, Joe Hall. Hey, Jake.
Thanks so much for joining us, Tim, and we'll just dive right into our first question, which is what thinkers excite you right now?
So when you sent me the list of questions, Joe, I found all of them very difficult. And it made me think a lot about the nature of questions because, you know, like the language isn't all that difficult, but it made me think a lot about the source of questions. And, you know, there's that famous idea that in a job interview, if you can somehow turn the question that's being asked to you by the superior into something that you actually want to answer, it might be a better way to go. And in that transformation, you're actually revealing something about yourself that may not even have to do with the content, you know, the direct address of the question. And so with the first one with thinkers, after not liking that question for a while, because I first was thinking about all the books I'm reading this summer, you know, et cetera, and like, who do I want to name drop and quote and all that shit. I felt like the thinkers that are mattering most to me this summer are not from books. So it's not theoretical. It's not, you know, treatises, essays, polemic. I think the thinkers that are influencing me a lot this summer are those who are actually just in the process of doing, which is interesting because thinking, if I limit it to that kind of intellectual mental box, I felt this allergy, like I didn't want to do that. But if I'm giving readings like at the Omega Institute or here in town at Mirabai, and I'm just, you know, either 25 minutes or 50 minutes with someone faced with really major issues about their love life, their health, their career prospects or lack thereof, it's interesting to me that there's a lot of thinking that goes across the transom, you know. And I find myself really engaged with that, that, you know, what do people who maybe don't have the same academic background that I do, the same interest in reading and writing that I do, where do we meet? And there's a real big overlap. Like you really can't do this kind of work, you know, where you're giving someone a reading if you can't really be with them. And if they can't somehow feel like they can relate with the way that I think, then we're going to have a really hard time. And so your question made me think a lot about how do people who I, you know, cross paths with of all ages, what do they think about, you know, and then how do we meet there? And so on Netflix, I don't know if either of you guys have seen Keep Sweet about the fundamentalist LDS church. They're like a total polygamous cult. And, you know, their leader prophet, Warren Jeffs, is in prison right now. It's a 4-part series. It's horrific. I really want you guys to watch the first episode. You don't have to watch all of them. But it's a mindfuck. I mean, you just really, you really understand how gullible people can be. But also, if you're born into a really bad system, that you could just be, you know, exploited like crazy. And I only bring that up because those who are familiar with either in occults like the FLDS Church or even like Mormonism, right, of which I was a devout member of for a while until I came out of the closet in my early 20s, they believe in direct revelation, which means that if you pray earnestly, then God, through the medium of the Holy Spirit, will reveal his truth to you, which means that what you think is not just your thought, but it, like, it gets the stamp of approval by the big guy. Right? And which means everyone theoretically in the church can be a mouthpiece for God. And I just find that to be kind of an extraordinary thing to consider, that if we're so devout and, you know, have such a deep belief in a possibility like this, that our thinking, could we end up being mouthpieces for the divine? And that seems a little bit frightening, which I think this documentary, Keep Sweet and Pray, really, you know, drives home. And the last thing that I just want to sort of drop in a little bit. So one of the things that I do besides reading tarot and the I Ching, I give a lot of Akashic Records readings. And, you know, this is a term that hasn't been around that long, maybe just 120 years. First used by Madame Blavatsky in the 1880s, you know, the founder of Theosophy. And then later in the early 20th century, we would have practitioners like Edgar Cayce would probably be the most famous one, you know, where he would just sort of lie back on a settee and there'd be a client with either a physical or a spiritual ailment. And then he would just go back to the records and in a kind of trance state would give a prescription that would then help that individual. But all these sessions were transcribed. So we have all the readings today, like they're in print, and it's wild. And so I find that to be kind of an interesting metaphor. So when I give a reading, the way I explain it to a client, and most of them who get an Akashic Records reading, they've never had one before, right? So that's also kind of an interesting thing to think about. What is it that makes someone want to come get one in the first place? And I say, well, imagine if you get into an elevator and you go up 1,000 floors and the doors open, and what you see in front of you is a cosmic library. And that if you were to go in there and pull down one of those volumes on the spine, it would have your name on it, you know, Joe Hall, Jake Reber, right? And if you were to open the volume, it would have a record of everything you've done and said and thought, and which would include everything you didn't do and didn't say. So obviously it's a metaphor, because I don't think a physical volume could really contain all that data, right? And so the way I explain it is, well, if you were to meet like a Joe Hall who's 20 years older than you right now, right? Or a Jake Reber 15 years older, and they will have lived whatever you're about to live in the next 20 years, what would they say to you today that might be really helpful for you to hear? Right. Because the Akasha records, they exist out of time and space. So by not having that limitation, you're getting access to a kind of different realm of info. And I just want to sort of drop that into the conversation today at the start, because I think that would really change the way we think about our current problems and affairs, right? And I think at least two of your questions directly address the future, right? Which I also found very unappealing, like, you know, distasteful. Like, I read those and I was really mad at you. And I was like, how can you ask about the future? And so I have to think about how to make friends with those questions and not feel put upon or antagonized. And so that's the thing that I just kind of want to start with. Those are the ways that I'm most engaged with this question about, you know, what are some of the thinkers that I'm really kind of grappling with or, you know, delighted by.
Yeah, I really loved, right early on, you're saying thinkers in the act of doing. I think it's like a really productive kind of phrase and a way of rethinking even what that kind of designation of thinkers, you know, can it be expanded to allow for. A lot of the other things that you're kind of pointing toward were these various systems for meaning making. So I'm really curious how you, you know, personally access meaning or meaningfulness in your daily life.
Well, I want to start by saying that I worked with a Jungian analyst for 12 years, Jonathan Goldberg, and I think he's still alive right now. He trained half of the Jungian analysts in New York City, you know, right? And I was lucky. I was his final client. I don't think he was so lucky to have to go out with me. But one of the things that I learned is if we consider thinking, if we consider feeling, and also, right, intuition, and, you know, the last thing has to do with the body, sort of like the physical understanding. And Jung, he had a great abstraction. I just can't think of it right now. But feeling is the function of the psyche that gives value to everything. And so it's not exactly using the word meaning or meaningfulness, right? Full of meaning, but it's sort of my go-to. So in other words, you can read all these books and you can have these far-flung, super engaging intellectual conversations with a therapist, you know, especially if it's like, you know, cognitive therapy or something. But if the exchange of feeling between therapist and client is absent or weak, then it's not going to be very meaningful. And I would also apply that to myself as a teacher, right? So if the rapport in the room, and if I'm not checking in with what's happening in the room in terms of these different feeling states, is there a space being made that allows for a lot of them, even if it's conflicting and contentious? And is it the kind of space where people will feel comfortable not only having their own feelings, but maybe bringing them into the discourse? And it's really important, because I notice I just go brain dead if I'm in a room and all these smart things are being said, like at a party. You know, you're at a party with a bunch of, heaven forbid, poets.
That's right? The worst. Terrible.
It's the worst, right? My husband is a visual artist, and he will not go with me to anything like a social event after reading. He just says, poets are mean. And I said, and visual artists are? And he goes, no, they're not. He says, you have gone with me to a lot of things after openings, and it's totally different. And I don't completely agree with him, but I understand what he's sort of getting at. So what, to me, is requisite for meaning making and meaningfulness is to be in a feeling state. So even like doing this interview today, you know, even though we started recording a little bit late, but that sense of we're three people here having feelings is important to me, right? And so I would also say a personal dimension, not just like a machine dimension. And I know that's another word that comes up on the prep questions. I feel like, you know, those questions are sort of like you're about to go to the doctor and like get a colonoscopy, and they give you like a list of prep. And that's how those questions felt, Joe Hall. And I have nothing against machines. I mean, we're connecting through amazing technology that we probably couldn't have dreamed of, you know, 10 years ago, et cetera. But what I mean is that if we're kind of mechanical and machine-like to the exclusion of feeling, right? Because that's the one thing I don't really, I'm not too concerned about hurting the feelings of the machines that I interact with. And it's not that the machines don't have value, but I have feelings about the machines. I have feelings about my devices, right? It's very personal. Like when you know, I left my jobs, I had to give up my MacBook Pro, I had to give it back to my school. And so it was, you know, we had these openings. So do I do the same thing and get another MacBook Pro? Do I get a Dell laptop? What do I do? Like, I almost died a year and a half ago. I almost drowned while skating, right? And so I had to get a new iPhone because it was kaput. It was totally flooded with water. Do I get the next version of the iPhone? Do I switch to a Samsung Galaxy? And what's funny is beyond all the specs and just the little list of things they can do, you know, and all the numbers and all that, I think we go by feeling, strangely, like with these devices. And so that also gives things a kind of meaning, right? There's a couple other things I want to say about this. For me, what gives meaning also is contact with sentient beings. So of course, humans, but I'm also thinking of like my cat. I'm thinking about also the wildlife, right? All the creatures, all the bugs and stuff. I'm thinking about non-mammal sentient life, you know, trees and plants, mushrooms for sure. You know, right now the foraging season has just begun. And like tomorrow I'm going to go, it's mighty. We had a huge, huge downpour. And, you know, those, when mushrooms fruit, you know, when the mycelium gets stressed out and they fruit, those are major intelligences, like the natives, of our climate here knew all about that. And it's not just psychedelics, you know, it's like the intelligence of chanterelles and the intelligence of bleats and black trumpets. And they can really give you a lot of information in the same way that pot, like cannabis, is definitely a medicinal plant. And so is tobacco. So if I have a cigar on my porch, it's part of meaning making, because I know that the tobacco is a medicine. And so I'm taking it in. I'm also giving it out into the little area that I live in and sort of giving it back to all the little spirits. And so the sentient beings can also be in non-flesh, you know, non-physical form. They can be in other realms of consciousness. And so if you make contact with that, and that's a part of your life, it makes life pretty meaningful, right? So to me, again, like that, I just know that's what's happening in my little world, you know, and I don't want to get all hocus pocusy about it. I just want to be more like a matter of fact, you know, these are the things that really make life feel like pretty full of meaning. And the last thing I want to say is, and this is coming back again to clients that I meet with for tarot readings, intuitive guidance, and stuff like that. One of the most asked questions is, what is my purpose in life now? Right. So in other words, they could have had answers like we all do previously, but somehow right now, those answers don't seem to be sticking very well. Right. Whether it's the pandemic, whether they're, you know, going through a life change, A lot of people, clients I see, are kind of in late midlife. And what they're really looking at is late life and also getting much more closer to their own deaths. And then when when they ask the question, what's my purpose? It translates into, what am I going to do with my remaining time that's going to be meaningful? And if I don't find the answer, like, in other words, I can't just keep doing what I've been doing. Like, that's a dead end. It might have been really cool in my 40s raising all these kids, but they're all gone now. Or it might have been really cool climbing the corporate ladder or becoming, a television anchor at a station. Yesterday I had a client, 30-year anchor at ABC, and I'm actually going to go watch her tomorrow because I don't watch ABC, and I just thought, oh, that's kind of cool. And so people are always trying to think about this question of, what's my purpose? And in a way, what I love about machines is it seems like they have a pretty defined purpose. So maybe that's not why they're asking, about this question about meaning, because, it's so well defined, and maybe that's the appeal. If there are aspects of ourselves that can just be more like a machine, like when we're teaching just a little, a dispensary of knowledge, or if we're with a lover and we're in bed and we're just a little sex machine, then we don't have to think about, is this meaningful? You just do the service, right? Well, I didn't know we'd be going there, connecting some of these questions, but.
Yeah, well, I feel like you're doing our work for us. That's amazing. So I'll put a twist on our machine question, because I love these answers, and there's a lot of ways to follow them. But one of the things you've really been talking about is the role of feeling, and then also the divine in meaning making, in communication and meaning, almost occurring in a very present ritual space. And so I'm just curious, in regard to, the way we've been talking about machines, do those have a role to play in that space? Like, for you, is there a relationship between access to the divine and the mechanical, or are those two things that are really far apart for you?
So the first thing I think of is, in the pandemic, especially in the first year, the Omega Institute was shut down. So in 2020, there was no season, right? So I didn't work for 5 months that I normally do, right? June through the end of October. The place up here, the New Age bookstore, Mirabai, no in-person readings, just gone. And so I needed machines. I needed either Zoom or FaceTime or phone were the three ways to have readings with clients. So what's funny is, in person, what you have to do in a reading, okay, just you guys, when you go get readings, you got the reading bug. One of the things you really want to check with a reader, they just have to do two things. And if they don't, they're bogus. And you really, so this is like a little pearl I'm giving you. The first thing is, they have to ground the reading. Okay, so there's a million ways to do it. You can hit a gong, you can light incense, you can say a little prayer, to Heavenly Mother, or, whatever you want to do, to Zeus or Apollo if you want. And then when the reading's over, the reader doesn't have to do this with you, but they should let you know that they're going to clear the reading. And that just means that we close the space, we close the portal, which they'll reopen for the next client. So there are a lot of different versions. You could do the same thing. You could hit a Tibetan singing bowl, light a little incense, throw a little salt, hit tuning forks, clap your hands, dance around a circle. I mean, whatever you want, but that sense is that this reading's over. And so when it comes to machines, it's interesting, right? Because you can just turn off the Zoom call, close the FaceTime window, hang up the phone. So, but is that really enough? Maybe there needs to be something else that's sort of around that. And so I, you know, and let's face it, if we get beyond electronics and how helpful they are, like right at this moment in our being able to meet tonight, in a way, you know, the very primitive technology, I guess, for, in my mind, a Tibetan singing bowl is a machine, right? In a very primitive way. Or even if you're going to light a little cone of incense and put it in a little incense burner, right? That strikes me as a machine, right? And so these are things that are either they exist out there in nature or they're human made and stuff like that, little devices that we use, right, to enhance and experience. So in that sense, maybe a tarot deck is also a machine, right? In a kind of, you know, imaginative way, the way that I also have a tarot app on my phone, which, you know, I usually don't use when I'm doing a 25, 50 minute session, but I might, because wherever I go, I always have a deck with me at all times, right? And, you know, I have a little bag of Hocus Pocus that I keep in the trunk of my car. So as, if I drive anywhere, I can always, you know, I can always give like a full blown reading. Like, Joe, if I, you know, drive to Buffalo, you know, I've got my gear. So so this is also a kind of interesting thing. And so, I mean, right now I'm very conscious that I'm on my laptop with you. My refrigerator is humming. My cell phone, I use the notepad on the iPhone that I wrote the notes, just little thoughts I had about the preparatory questions and stuff like that. I know that like 25,000 homes up here in Ulster County right now are without power because we had a really severe thunderstorm that came through yesterday. I don't know how far north it went, if you guys got a little bit of that too, right? And so I was thinking a lot like, oh, you know, for whatever reason, I have power this time, right? Or I would have had to climb in my car, another machine, and go down to Stewart's, right, where there's a cell phone signal, so then on my phone I could get on Zoom with you and like do this, right? Which is how I have to teach class when the power goes out here for like a few days, right? So in that sense, I feel like we're just like surrounded by machines. And I mean, I'm kind of unplugged up here. I don't have cell service. I don't have TV, but I guess I'm not, because, you know, when the power goes down, then I really know. So I guess that's my way of thinking of when we're talking about spiritual practices, even rituals or access. The plan B is the machineless version. And otherwise, a lot of times the machines that are in our lives, I totally take them for granted. It's almost like I don't even think about them, right? Until they're not working. And so in that sense, I like to think that I'm not that separate from a machine, that physically we might occupy a certain amount of space, but I'm so connected with them in my psyche that it's almost like an extension of an arm or something, right? And so that they're not really like these separate things. They're just parts of me that are working until they're not. And so I'll just mention one last thing, which is, you know, I had a bad machine encounter. So 10 days ago, I parked my car, alternate side parking in the city, in a nice little spot. And there was a motorcycle that was just parked behind me. And, you know, it's one of these situations where if I could just move it 2 feet, it would make enough space for another car, right? But the way that we kind of got in there, it was like we're wasting a lot of space for the two of us when there could easily be three. So I was in a very kind of charitable mood towards a stranger I'd never see. And I walked over to his motorcycle and I saw the keys were in the ignition. And I just like, you know, this is fate. I'm going to move this fucker. And I looked around and make sure the person wasn't coming back, because they'd probably kill me. They think I'm stealing their bike, which I'm not. So I grabbed the handlebars without straddling it, and I kicked the kickstand and the whole thing started tipping. And I had no idea motorcycles weigh that much. Like, they are heavy,
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, my point of reference is like a moped or something. And then this just thing started going and it was going to hit the ground, and it was rolling, and its back wheel luckily hit the curb, which helped to stabilize it. But at that point, my left wrist was already like 2 feet above the ground, twisted.
Mm.
And to keep it from hitting the ground, I lifted that thing back up, and I knew I had hurt my wrist. You know, so I was just like massaging. I went and sat on the bench in the park across from my apartment, and I saw this guy come out. So he was holding like a cover, and he did not see me, but he came out and had this perplexed look, like that motorcycle is not where I left it, you know? And it's sort of like, am I misremembering, or did it move by itself? Right. You know, et cetera. And I didn't say a thing. And so long story short is I sprained my wrist, right? And so it's now recovered. You know, 10 days later, it was a minor sprain, painful, but I had my first workout today with you know, back on the Nautilus circuit, other kinds of machines. But I was very conscious that the hand and the wrist, the ulna bone and the nerves, that's like a total machine. Because I really damaged that machine and realized how much I use this all the time, not thinking about it. And so just like a phone that all of a sudden doesn't work, or, you know, like a pump in my septic pump house has been failing this summer, you know, really has your attention. So I think bodily injury is such a teacher that brings our attention to how machine-like our bodies are. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I'm sure we've all been like up late at night just thinking, how can we be made of like billions of cells that are just doing their amazing shit without us?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how does that work? You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. So I think it's helpful. I like not thinking of a machine as an object to be acted upon, but something that I'm a part of.
You know, that's a really memorable way of presenting it, to think that we're, you know, constituted by machines, and when we're feeling fluid, are just taking part in this like infinitely complex interlinkages of things that are working as they're supposed to. But if we don't have facility with something mechanic, it could just kill us.
Yeah, I really love that kind of blurriness or slippage of machines, right, as these external and internal operators, something that can work with us or we can work with, but they can also work on us, as you're saying, even potentially in dangerous or hazardous ways. So shifting slightly, but still thinking of the way things might work on us, what do you like art, or what would you like art, thought, or writing to do to you, kind of in an ideal sense?
Yeah, like that was another question that just like drove me crazy.
You're not the first person to hate our questions.
No, I didn't hate it. I felt really challenged. Like it felt like a foreign entity invading. In other words, like this question you just asked about art, you know, and what I wanted to do to me, I think, wow, that's such a good question that I would have never come up with on my own. Like, so in other words, like when I wake up in the morning, I don't think, well, what do I want art or this poem, you know, or this bowl of cereal to like do to me? Like, in other words, that whole construct, it seems like a very basic sentence, but it's probably not one that I think usually, right? And so that's it. So I don't hate the questions, but I felt a little bit like challenged, like, whoa, what am I going to do with this question? And so I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm going to answer your question, and then I want to come back a little bit to the previous one, because there's one other important thing I want to say about really spiritual practice and machines. So I thought about this question, and I finally had to go on my machine here on my phone and look up this quote by Neruda, which I have in my head, but I wanted to get the translation accurate. he says, and you know, for me, he's one of the great love poets. Some of my favorite poems ever, love poems, are written by Neruda. Like, do you know the one, "You Are the Queen," like that one? Okay, anyway, just file that away.
Okay.
But he said at the end of this really famous poem of his, "I want to do to you what spring does to the cherry trees." I mean, that's a winner. Like, dude, like, awesome. "I want to do to you what spring does to the cherry trees." I love that very much. And so that's kind of like my response, what I want art, you know, it's like that James Wrightian, like, I just want to break into blossom, you know, that kind of thing. You know, there's another famous quote too by Camus. Yeah. Okay. So here we go. And you know, this is, forgive the sexist language, just put in human or woman. "A man's work is nothing but this slow trek to rediscover, through the detours of art, those two or three great and simple images in whose presence his heart first opened." I just love this. I'll read it one more time. So "A person's work is nothing but this slow trek to rediscover, through the detours of art." That's so grand. I love "this slow trek to rediscover, through the detours of art, those two or three great and simple images." And Jung would love that, right? "Those two or three great and simple images in whose presence their hearts first opened." So I'm cheating here twice now. So once with Neruda and then once with Camus. And that seems to be, at least for me, like a satisfactory answer, like, to what I want. Now, if I wanted to be funny, I could also quote Roland Barthes, who's one of my favorite thinkers. And I would just say, as far as art and writing and thinking, what I want it to do is to hold your attention in the way that a striptease holds someone's attention. Like, that's my job as a writer, as an artist, as a thinker, which I think is also like a beautiful kind of thing to desire, because it eroticizes the whole proceedings, right? To hold your attention. So here's the thing about machines and spiritual revelation and practice. I know back in the day, and I'm going to say, we have to go back to Descartes, that there's this like moment in Western thinking, a big question of, if there is a creator, right? Is it a deistic creator or a theistic creator, right? So is it a theistic personage that we can communicate with either directly through prayer or through an intermediary, you know, like a priest or something? Or is it more a deistic model where God's the watchmaker and he sets the machine of the world going and he goes away, right? So we have, you know, and so the reason why I've thought about this a lot when I was a Mormon is because the Mormons really, you know, embrace this kind of theistic, personal God the Father that gives you revelation and stuff. So in a kind of wicked way, tonight, while we're sitting here just talking, I was thinking about, there must be speculative fiction and science fiction in which God, you know, themselves is a machine. And it could be something as funny as like the Wizard of Oz, right? So, you know, something like that. Or it could be something, you know, like Hal in like 2001. Or, you know, I've been watching, I don't know if you guys watch Westworld, but, you know, I like Westworld on HBO, and there's always a kind of machine-like God in like every season, right, that needs to be destroyed, right, that houses all the consciousnesses, whether it's humans or, you know, the robots. It's funny because I think when I consider divinity, it's all those things. In other words, there's an aspect of communing with the divine that feels personal to me, like theistic. And then there's another part of me that feels like it's just like energy, like the universe is just this well-tuned machine. And, you know, this Eastern idea of being in the Tao, in the way, it's just you recognize how your gears are turning, like what is your part to play in this thing that's just grinding on, you know, something like that, where the idea of a personage is sort of not in the foreground. It's sort of, you know, receded. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in because that was sort of floating through my head when we're talking.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, it also, you know, just riffing with that makes me think of the relationship between like scripture, revelation, and before you'd been talking about these sort of books that contain entire transcripts, but the relationship between like scripture and the word of the divine and like, you know, like programming code and things like that, which, you know, structure these sort of worlds in which we're all sort of making meaning. And there's this drive to sort of like unveil those codes, but at the same time, we do sort of suspend our belief in them or just allow ourselves to go with them in order to like, you know, proceed.
And Joe, just to like reflect on what you just said, I love the metaphor of scripture, almost like one's own Akashic record is you're reading like the scripture produced by your actions, you know, and thoughts that that someone who's going to the records, they're about to read a holy book that somehow they've authored by the lives they've led, but they've never read, right? That they've only lived. And that's an interesting weirdness to think about.
Yeah, and it is
right, because this is actually a very rich metaphor, certainly in Judeo-Christian tradition, the idea that, you know, on judgment day the books will be opened, right? And there's this idea even of a book of remembrance or a book of life, right? And the idea is your name written in the book of life? Like, what is the narrative that the life that you lived makes? Because by that you will be judged. Yeah, so it builds in that everyone is, in a way, writing a book that then will be read. And, you know, if it bores God, you're fucked, you know? Cast you out. I mean, he's like the dude at Publishers Weekly that's either going to give you a star review and you go to heaven, or just you get panned and you're like kicked out of the kingdom.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, and there's also the idea that you can download your book of life as it has been written online by like requesting all your files from Facebook or something. So like, you know, you're writing your own book and then these other books are constantly being compiled and predicted.
Yeah.
So as we're thinking about technology, as we're thinking about the world changing around us, you know, and meaning making, what do you want your own artistic practice to look like in 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, that particular question I felt a stronger allergy to than some of the other ones. Because, and this is why, I guess one of the ways I try to live my life, because it sounds good to me, and so this isn't a prescription for everyone, but I find that my focus on the here and now is a good way to go. I felt like when I was a Mormon, it was sort of like the layaway plan where, you know, the sort of future reward of heaven was worth giving up a lot of things for. So like as a gay dude, that would mean like celibacy, like give up your erotic life, you know, a full physical partnership with like another dude, because then you're going to get the rewards. You will have passed the test. And I had to really get as far away from that kind of thinking as possible. It took a long time, right? But once I did it, and once I found practices that were helpful for me in just being more present, things changed a lot, right? Because I don't really spend a whole lot of time thinking about the future. And it doesn't mean that I don't want to do my part and this is my favorite, you know, little thing when I was a Boy Scout, is we were always told, leave the campsite cleaner than when you got there, which I love, right? Mm-hmm. And in that spirit, I feel that way about this planet. And so it's very horrifying to think about, we all either ourselves or know people who are raising kids right now. and they're fucked. I mean, you just think about that. It's unimaginable. I think the things we're seeing right now fairly rapidly all over the world, these, and I'm not even talking about, you know, automatic weapons and regimes rising and falling and genocide, but just the convulsions of the planet, which will do just fine with, you know, without us, but it's going to take down all these other life forms with it. And I almost feel more diseased about that than about humans. I figure, well, we're driving around our stupid cars and, you know, doing all the shit. So we deserve to just get wiped off the face of this planet. But, you know, that cute little koala bear, I mean, it doesn't drive a car. What did it ever do wrong? You know, so I, you know, okay, I'm being funny, but I'm also kind of being serious here. But here's a more direct answer to your question about the future. So 20 years ago, so right after 9/11, right in 2002, I could not have imagined this Zoom call, for example. I mean, I was just getting sort of comfortable with the internet and like email, and that we survived Y2K. But even though there were environmentalists shouting like desert prophets 20 years ago saying, it's coming, it's coming. I mean, and they were doing that in 1970, right? But now it's like here. And what I'll say is, I wasn't trying to imagine what my poetics or what my writing practices would be in 2022. It just didn't seem like a question I was all that interested in. And I think right now, if I'm lucky to be alive, so if I'm alive in 2042, I'll be 76 years old, right? Turning 77. So, you know, it's a possibility. I put money on it, but I'm not thinking about what my practice will be as a writer or my poetics, because I don't care. I don't even care if I'm writing then, or if I, as long as I'm doing something that's soulful and meaningful, then when I get there, I'll know. It's not something I have to prepare for. Here are just a few other things besides that the future is unimaginable. The journey of time, to me, it's like a dance between continuity and disruptions. So I don't think I'm all that different of a poet or writer from 20 years ago, right? Because I'm not even that much different from when I was a grad student. And even like an undergrad, when I was first waking up to like poetry, like Mary Oliver, you know, stuff like that. I hadn't heard of Leslie Scalapino, you know, whatever. It took a while. But the idea there is there's something fundamental that there have been adjustments, but there's just kind of like a force that hasn't changed, that seems very recognizable to me. You know, even though I hadn't accomplished anything, I hadn't published in any magazines, I hadn't had a book yet, I hadn't given a reading. There's so much stuff I hadn't done, and I didn't even know I could, you know, aspire to do. But that sort of engagement with language and the excitement about encountering a poem and like just being like, you know, struck by the thing, and the desire to want to know more about this art form, I don't think that's changed a whole lot in even 30 or 40 years. And so I feel like there's something fundamental and conservative also that makes me very legible. If you would have met me when I was 20, you know, 1 years old at Brigham Young, I would still be really recognizable, you know, even as a practitioner of language, right? And, you know, poetry. And I guess lastly, I'll just say this. It's enough for me to just be my age, to be interested. Like, I've written a lot of poems this past year, you know, so I've had a beloved that's come back into my life. But in this year of being 56, you know, for another 2.5 months, I've written a ridiculous amount of poems. None of that I could have imagined last year at this time at all. And so that's a kind of, and you know, and I love this little four-letter word, that's a neat feeling. You know, neat is sort of like underappreciated. You know, it almost sounds a little antique, like groovy, like that's neat. But it's awesome. I mean, in fact, most of the time, I think people only use it when they want like a whiskey neat, right? Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes when we're living our lives and we're just writing our poems, and the metaphor is we're square on our horse and riding the engine of our imagination. And you see like the little detritus, just the little trail of little artifacts that we're leaving behind. It's nice to feel like, oh, that's kind of neat, you know, that's kind of cool. And so I'm feeling that right now. And that's a very separate thing than, you know, will someone else think that, you know, how will these things be received and how will they be completed as they must be? I'm not thinking about that a whole lot because that's also the future. And it's not that it doesn't matter. It does matter, but we can be so in the here and now that there's this deep pleasure that comes from writing what we need to be writing and making it, you know, as awesome as we can and being surprised by what that is, right? Knowing that this little crop could not have been written 5 years ago or it only could be written now. And so that's something that matters to me a lot more than thinking about my future poetics.
Yeah, I really like the movement there between talking about the future as being this unimaginable thing, but then also, as you're saying this, right within kind of the present moment, these unimaginable things arise as well, and being open to that kind of surprise. So to turn this kind of idea of the unimaginable on its head, thinking about what we imagine against, you know, its ability to be realized in the moment, was something that you believe, even though it's probably not true?
So this is a question that I really loved. I also found it challenging, but I really thought, wow, like that goes to something deep. And in fact, this is a question I would love to ask, you know, my students in the fall, like at some point. Right? What is something? And if I say it back to you, I want to make sure I'm hearing it right. So what is it that you believe that's probably not true? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I thought about that for a while, and I just wrote one sentence. And I believe human beings will find a way to reverse the damage they have already caused all other life forms on this earth. As something that I believe that's probably not true. So I'll just say it again. I believe human beings will find a way to reverse the damage they have already caused all other life forms on this earth.
Mm. Yeah, that's it's a seductive belief to recover, resurge, rebirth, all these things. Yeah, geez.
And it's like a kind of fantasy, again, like it could be a speculative fiction. Oh, the scientists will invent something that will suck all the microplastics out of the oceans, right? Or, you know, they'll do something that will chemically convert all the carbon greenhouse gases to something else that's less lethal. Or they'll find a way to condense it into a bullion cube and put it on a spaceship and just pollute whatever's out there, right, in the vacuum. I mean, those are like little fantasies that I have, that because really what we're looking at is just utter devastation that's irreversible, right? And the horror that if we're at 11:59 and 59 seconds towards, you know, the clock striking midnight, the added horror that there are all these imbeciles running around doing nothing, or like worse, you know, burning down more rainforests. And we see this kind of suicidal logic of global capital, like a freight train, runaway freight train. And it's just, it's almost like we can't live with that 24/7. We just have to know this is so fucked up and then we get in our cars and go to Montreal, you know? Eat some good food. I mean, it's insane. It's insane. And I would say right now, you know, this is brought home to me, like on Facebook, when I'm watching all my bougie friends get on planes and traveling to Europe this summer. People are traveling a lot more than they have in the previous two summers. And I don't know, it's a little hard for me to be like pressing hearts and likes and shit like that. So I'm like, what are you doing fucking getting on a plane? Like, that's like the worst thing you could do. It's so bougie and selfish and entitled and privileged. And in my mind, I'm just like, I'm willing to never get on another plane if everyone agrees. You see, and of course, that's not going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. Because the money behind the airline industry, it's just ridiculous, right? So, and, you know, a worse example would be these fucking Virgin space shuttles, you know, these space shuttle flights funded by Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, right, is the other person. I don't know. It just seems insane. Mm-hmm. And even NASA seems insane, right? They want to put another bunch of people on the moon in 2025. It's going to be this time a multicultural group. Hopefully they won't blow up like an explorer, right? You know, whatever. But it's like, I just think, are you insane? Like, you know what else we could do with those billions of dollars that could help the people down here? It's that kind of thing that just drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. And so this is the thing. I want to believe that we can correct the damage that we've already caused to all other life forms on this earth. But I don't know. I think it's not true. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you put your finger right on a number of narratives like space travel, the colonization of space, like carbon capture, which, you know, it seems like there's a ton of money going in producing those beliefs in order to allow us to cop out of actually facing the reality of, yeah, maybe not stepping on planes for the foreseeable future. Well, this leads me to the question about waste, since we're talking about microplastics and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and all those people, you know, because a lot of people associate the term waste with a lot of climate catastrophe and crisis. But this is from the artist Paul Thek, the question, what is waste?
Yeah. And I mean, Joe, that question just has your fingerprint all over it, you know, because I think of you as the ur authority on waste.
Well, I tried to shoulder it. I tried to push it off to Paul Thek. Yeah.
Right. Among people that I've had the privilege to know, like if I have a question about waste, I'm giving you a call.
Okay.
So I thought I would get personal with this question and just sort of meditate on it while also enlisting a few choice titles to be funny. So the first thing that comes to mind is I wrote what the body / doma, right? So habitation wants to be rid of is one way that I think about waste. So it's the excrement, the excoriae, because we're a system. So like, you know, on a very basic level, it could be every exhalation is waste, it's CO2, right? But one person's waste is another living form's nutrients, right? So waste is kind of interesting because in a system, it's actually quite helpful, right? Like all our shit, you know, making fertilizer, you know, and all our breaths, you know, plants are happy, and then they give us their waste product, which we love, you know? So, but I like this idea. It's what the body, the doma, wants to be rid of. The next go-to as I think of distaste, dissmell, disgust of rot / decay is another way I think. So it's also like programmed in the body why we have the olfactory system and all that. It's also like keeping what's toxic at a distance, right? So there's also that fact that, you know, and I think on a stinky day, like last 5 days have been really hot, right? So if there's no trash collection, this really is very at the forefront, that that kind of fetid, intense thing that we want to magically disappear, right? Mm-hmm. That we want the little sanitation people to work their magic so we don't have to think about it. And so in a way, I mean, so it is this kind of sanitized existence where we're not even conscious of our waste so that we can just use, and use, right? This is also the problem, I think, of certainly affluence, and I blame global capital again, right? That rather than things being in a kind of system or imbalance, the consumer side is all about just eating, right? So things are way out of balance. Okay, so here's some of my quotes. So I love that poem by Robert Bly, the final sentence, driving around, I will waste more time, right? And it, remember that poem, he's just like, it's a snowstorm. He's in Minnesota, and he's just looking at little mailboxes. It's like four lines of doing that. And then driving around, I'll waste more time. And so that's the kind of waste that's really liberating. Time, like wasting time, could be seen as a pejorative. And like the ur pejorative of that sentiment is, you know, that final line of Lying in a Hammock by James Wright, you know, I have wasted my life. So that's just not like I've wasted an hour. It's like I've wasted my life, right? Which, you know, and he stole that from a Tang Dynasty poet, right? Look it up. Poetry, you, right? And that interests me a lot. Waste as a verb in relation to time, that it could be kind of like unstructured, a kind of release or freedom from the schedule. You know, driving around, I will waste more time. Or it could just be this horrific, like, your life is a waste. You've wasted everything. I have wasted my life. And then I just wrote this randomly. Waste is one end of the supply chain, right? Because in the pandemic right now, in our second year, 2.5 years in, right, we're dealing with a lot of severe supply chain issue. I mean, on a very daily level, for me, it's just been a nightmare to get cat food, canned cat food, because my 15-year-old cat, she's just so fucking finicky, and she'll only eat very specific things. And a lot of those I can't get. And so I'm driving from store to store, not wasting more time, but wasting more gas to keep my cat fed while destroying the planet. And also, like, I just want to say, as a publisher and an editor, we know right now there are all these delays with books because the supply chain, the ink and the paper, it's not happening. You know, it's just a big frustration. I had to go look up the Paul Thek, and I believe I got this correct, that he asks four questions. They're all very small questions, but in a row, of which what is waste is the third in a list of four. So I wanted to read that, which is, what is greed? What is sacred? What is waste? Why are you here? That little series, like those four little beads on a string, I found really interesting. What is greed? What is sacred? What is waste? And why are you here? And I just love that. Almost like to not answer those, but just to, like, almost like a little mantra, just to say the questions. It creates a kind of constellation. It kind of maps out a space that I find profound. And it, in some ways, it changes the nature of this question a little bit to have these other ones dancing with it. I was a little surprised at the etymology of waste, which I'm Joe. I mean, you've probably known this since you were born. Especially some of the words include unoccupied. That surprised me. Mm-hmm. And especially with Occupy Wall Street, you know, unoccupied, almost like a vacancy at a motel, right? Or let's say, if if a Supreme Court justice all of a sudden dropped dead, then one of those chairs would be unoccupied. Let's say six of them. Yeah, what if six of them dropped dead? I wonder which six, and we'd have some unoccupied seats at SCOTUS. Uncultivated also surprised me, right? Both in that agrarian sense, almost like a field that's good to go. What do you want to plant? And it's not just like it's a fertilized field, but there's something really neutral about uncultivated. And of course, you know, we can't help but hear uncultured as well, you know, something like that, blank slate, tabula rasa as a kind of waste. And then of course, the word desolate, that seems really harsh. I mean, I remember first encountering that word in the Bible, you know, where they say laid waste and made desolate. Right. So that's, I think it's like the fear of God, you know, and I was reminded because it's 2022. So it's the centenary of Eliot's The Wasteland. Right. And then I recently just saw the geriatric The Who, and they closed their concert with Baba O'Reilly. And I was just thinking, it's funny to think about Eliot's Wasteland with teenage Wasteland, you know? and so your question made me sort of play with some of these different parts together. And it surprised me that, boy, I mean, the word waste vectors out in a lot of surprising ways I hadn't really considered.
Yeah, I really like that. You know, the slippage in the way that we think about waste. Joe, at one point you were talking about desirable waste there. And Tim talking about the idea of wasting time as both this kind of potential for it to be horrific, but also to be a liberating experience. You know, and then this idea of like unoccupied time, I think it pairs really nicely with our, what might be considered the fifth question coming from Paul Thek, which is, what is leisure? I'm interested maybe if that plays at all off of some of these ways that we're starting to expand this notion of waste.
I think this was like, this question to substitute waste for leisure felt like, now this is advanced Dungeons and Dragons a little bit. So once again, I wanted to look up his question. Maybe we'll start there. Again, he had a tetrad. So, and in this case, the leisure question was at the tail end. And he said, what is capitalism, communism, socialism, and then what is leisure? And so the way that I kind of read this construction is depending on what kind of economic political system you find yourself in, that it seems like this notion of leisure is going to change a lot, right? And also I might add, what is leisure like seasonally in the summer versus the winter? What is leisure in Buffalo versus here in Woodstock versus in the city versus Yosemite, right? That's burning right now. So I also wrote, what is leisure in relation to class strata, in relation to ethnic habits? It seems like it just changes a lot, you know, the possibilities of what leisure is. And so I did want to think about the etymology of leisure. And I was a little bit surprised because the word I got was to be allowed. So it has a little bit different ring to it than like leisure class or something like that. You know, like privilege, like you have time to take vacations, you know, to go boating on your yacht, to take your family, you know, kayaking, just to be allowed. I mean, almost felt like I, and then this wasn't in the etymology, but I wrote these down because they were alliterative to my ear. So I just wrote down license to, and I also wrote down laissez-faire in my brain, like this is the realm of leisure. And it made me, because, you know, to be allowed to, I think my parents, like, you know, they only allowed me to do certain things when I was growing up, and I couldn't wait to like get out of that house. Because my idea of leisure was very different than theirs. What I wanted to allow myself was a taller order than what they thought was fitting. And so I would then bring that to like a marriage or long-term relationship. There's the leisure that you take together, but then there's also all sorts of leisures that we may have to deny ourselves or sacrifice for the sake of that relationship that we would love to allow ourselves to do. So it becomes an interesting thing. And also, you know, I don't know, I haven't looked the etymology for pleasure. I mean, sure, so many letters with leisure that I wonder if there's some sort of underground current there, you know, connecting those words. Because, especially because, you know, we're such a sort of puritanical frame of, you know, American culture, that there's just so much that I feel like just coming up through families and schools and church, that there's so much that you're not allowed to do. And I would also say that in academia right now, like post Me Too, post BLM, all great movements, but there's a sort of countervalence to the swing of the pendulum, where I also feel like my discourse is more straitjacketed now in academia than it used to be. Like, in some strange way, because now there are all these things that I'm not allowed to say without a huge penalty. And a lot of these things I just agree with, but I don't agree with all of them. So I'm going to be funny. Let's do concrete examples. There's a novella that I love. The memory space in my brain is not large enough to say this Austrian author's name correctly. So I had to look it up. Okay. So do you guys know the novella called Baby Fucker? Okay.
Yes.
So Jake, yeah. Like, okay, you guys are both nodding. Good. Right. So I taught Baby Fucker to a graduate class 10 years ago, and they loved it. We all loved it. And I just reread it like in the last 6 months. I thought I haven't read Baby Fucker in a while. And I think it's more brilliant now than ever. It's like shocking to me, the arc of that piece. I think the translation is terrific, right? Le Figue did it, published it. And it's Urs Alemann, right? And I always want to say Ullman, like I say, it's Alemann, right? Which is perfect. And I feel constrained, like I would never teach Baby Fucker again. It's too triggering. This guy like fucks babies that he keeps under his bed on every page. It's disgusting. Right. And so I guess that's a leisure I'm not allowed anymore, like in the zeitgeist, you know? And so I want to choose that as an example because it's less touchy than race, which is super touchy. Although I would say it touches on, well, I don't know, such as Me Too. It's just, let's just say it. It's just like fantastic pedophilia. And also, you know, infanticide. Because a lot of these little babies, I don't think survive the attention here from the baby fucker. All right. So I feel upset because why not teach this thing? It has so much value. I think it's great. Novel, a great novella, a great work of art, but I just think it's not going to go over well. Do you guys know what I'm saying? Like, so
yeah, I think that what I'm hearing is a sort of like weaponization of the ways in which, you know, like discourses that demand language that is like understanding and respectful of social justice movements have also been like sort of inverted you know, in ways that we see like the CRT thing being inverted, which is, you know, like that this makes us feel unsafe. Like, you know, teaching this history is triggering, you know, like the kids in the classroom. And then there's this rich vein of literature whose purpose is to transgress and which is to upset the reader. And that in this push and pull between, you know, like trying to understand what is sayable and not, you have a whole genre of literature whose very purpose is to do that, which seems unthinkable teaching in the classroom. I don't know if that may be an unfair summary, but I think that's sort of how I was translating it into how I've been thinking about these issues.
And so you're thinking, well, sometimes I'm going to stand up and we're going to look at Celine, but a lot of times it's like, fuck it. I don't want to deal with that this semester. And luckily there's plenty of other material to look at, that at least you make a calculation that it's much less likely you're going to be called in to have to defend, you know, why are you teaching this, a text that is upsetting, you know, these folks.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the way in which, like, you're reading leisure as something that is like shot through with society's definitions of what is permissible, right? Versus what the individual desires.
Now, if I wanted to be funny, to take it out of this kind of literary realm, I could also say, if one is on a business trip and you've concluded business and you have a weekend in town and you're away from spouse and family and, you know, this whole world of meaning making that you left behind, what leisures will you seek on your own, right? Before you hop on the plane and go back to the life that you know. And we could also say the same thing, people who go to the AWP conference, or people go to the McDowell colony, and all of a sudden they're removed from the routines of what they have committed themselves to and remain committed to, but they have a window. It's like a little vacation. If they want, they could indulge in all sorts of leisures that might not be available in the life that they've left that is waiting for them, right? So this is, in fact, a condition, certainly, I'm going to say, for hundreds and thousands of years in many, many cultures, is that sense we have these moments where we travel somewhere and we're out of the space that we live in most of the time. And I would say it's very revealing and might expose the depths of someone's imagination, which could include surprise, even their own depravity, you know, literally what they've deprived themselves of, right? That is so interesting. So that's why I find this like such a deep question, because leisure is life or death. The choices use as our leisures. It seems like in the end, like life or death, because when we're on our deathbeds, if we're so lucky, we're not, you know, shot by a bullet in a shopping mall or something like that. If we have a little time to linger, are we going to be that dude that's full of regret because we've denied ourselves those leisures that we were always wildly curious about? I don't want to be that dude. And I'm not that dude. I am a fucking hedonist. And I've been a hedonist for like decades in here and now. And I've made mistakes, but I shoulder guilt, right, over some bad decisions or maybe decisions that I've hurt other people. But I'm not a guy going to my deathbed with a whole lot of regrets. Right. And I feel like, so on a deep level for me, philosophically, leisure brings up this question.
Ha! That's a hard one to transition out of, Tim.
So, I fuck babies.
we'll just let it ring. Just give it the moment that it deserves. There's no transitioning out of that. I feel like this reduces the question of leisure to the mortal stakes of it to something pretty banal at this point, but these are the questions we have. So from baby fucker to what have you been listening to, Tim?
This question I found maybe the most agreeable.
It's good. You really just want things to put on a playlist. Yeah.
So I'm being funny, First thing I wrote down was my Bose 301 Series 5 that I just won at an auction. And I used to sell high-end stereo equipment when I was in high school and the first years of college. So I know a lot about great stereo equipment. And, you know, I always thought it'd be cute to have a pair of Bose 301s. So these Series 5s, I got them for like $150. And, you know, when you go to an auction, okay, the last thing you want to buy is electronic anything, because half the time it's broke. And unless you're like an amazing electronics dude, you know, who can fix it, you're screwed. You're just, you know, you're paying money to cart something away that's very heavy. But they worked perfectly when I got them home. And I got them together with a Yamaha digital piano. So I got the whole thing, the Bose 301s and the Yamaha for $300. Right, it was amazing. And so I've been listening to that. When I was preparing for this, I said, as of last night, the south side of my living room and sunroom has shorted out, so there's no power. So now I'm not listening to anything. But I was wondering about rodents in the walls, like chewing the wires. And so I have been listening to like their little pitter patter every day, right? So I share my Doma with other guests. And, you know, I just, my 15-year-old cat, she used to be such a good mouser, and she has failed me this summer for sure. She is not doing her job. And then I thought, I'll tell you the concerts I've been to in 2022. Not only do I listen to them play live, but for usually for several days or weeks after, I'm, you know, listening to their whole catalogs again. So Ricky Lee Jones, I heard Devo, Final Date. So their final tour was this year. It was only two dates and we saw them on the final one. So as far as I know, no one will ever see Bougie Boy again. Think about that. I heard Kraftwerk at Mass Mocha. They had a 3D show, which was kind of interesting to listen to that. Tears for Fears at Jones Beach. I just heard X at the rooftop of the pier. And then I saw The Who, which I mentioned. And so later this summer, I will see, I mean, you're going to see like what a little privileged doofus I am. So I'm seeing Lady Gaga. Nice. I'm seeing Roger Waters. And then on my birthday, I'm listening is the word. I'll be listening to Pavement, which I've never heard live in concert.
Oh, so I'm like, I'd kill to see that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a Pavement virgin. So that, and I bought that ticket a year in advance. Like it sold out in like 3 hours and it was for a year later. I'm like, all right, I love Pavement. I'll do it. Right. Cause some of those dudes, they went to UMass Amherst when I was there. Like what's his face? The one who died, not in Pavement. So who was the poet who died, who did David Berman, right? Yeah. Actual heir. He was in my workshop with James Tate.
Wait, what?
And I just didn't even know that. Like I was so like oblivious, you know, like I remember. But also one of the dudes in Pavement was in that workshop as well. They were all there in Amherst at the time. And I didn't know. I don't think it was like Stephen Mockmus, right? Isn't that his name? The mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways, that's what I'm listening to.
really kind of sprawling range of music that obviously are things that'll be fun to return to, add to our playlist. So I believe we have one final question. What is the poetry, writing, or medium of the future?
That's a really challenging question because, well, I'll, and then of course I have a cheating answer, which is my favorite one, but I actually want to answer this a little bit off the cuff a little bit. I feel like poetry cannot win the fight against media entertainment. So I'll start by saying that. So Disney Plus, Netflix, Marvel movies. And not to mention all the sort of 3D AI technologies, right, that we can already experience at these conventions, at Comic-Cons, you know, a lot of demos there. And so in view of that, coupled with the destruction of the planet and life as we know it, this is a very difficult question, right? Because if your backyard is burning, or if there's no water in the tap, or there's no wheat, like there's no flour, there's no food, I don't know. Like, this question seems irrelevant to me at a certain point. Like, it makes me think there have to be a lot of the basics in place for then poetry to happen. And it's not that poetry is not an essential practice or an essential good, but I think when the base is threatened, poetry is a luxury, even though for me, it's like a very necessary thing. But I don't know, like all those refugees fleeing Ukraine, you know, maybe we want to imagine some of them were reciting poems at night and it kept them alive. I'd like to believe that. I don't know. You know, I somehow think if you're a refugee on the run in the 21st century right now, you're just praying you have a free place to plug in your phone. Like, that's, and you could read poems off a phone if you want, but do you see what I'm saying? Like, it's like this device is also really in competition with the future of poetry. And I feel that a lot when I'm with my undergrads. Once upon a time, this is Dinosaur Tim speaking, you know, I'd walk into a classroom 10 minutes early and you just see some students there. Some of them are just getting caught up on the reading for that day. They haven't had a chance. They've been tired. You know, they're up all night. But others might be just reading some poems for fun. I don't see that so much anymore. And it's not that they're not doing it at all, but I'd say on the whole, they're doing it a lot less, because instead they're like texting and socially mediated and being entertained by YouTube and Instagram, and you know, and I'm a dinosaur. I don't even have TikTok. What's the other one they use? Like
Snapchat? Is it Snapchat?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And Snapchat's already old. But like for me, it's like, I'll just skip it. I've got enough to distract me, right? That's my shallow answer. And also I can rely on, hey, you guys, if you don't know by now that I'm a hedonistic here and now dude, enjoying my own leisures, I don't have time to think about the poetry of the future. A more serious answer, I want to read a longer quote from Derrida. And this is one of my favorite quotes from continental philosophy. So, you know, when I read Poetry of the Future, I first thought of Poésie de l'avenir. As you know, right, from French, that avenir, right, to come, is a much more compelling metaphor than the future. And this is what Derrida has to say. In general, I try and distinguish between what one calls the future and l'avenir, the to come. The future is that which tomorrow, later, next century will be. There is a future which is predictable, programmed, scheduled, foreseeable, like this Zoom call tonight, right? We had it on our little calendars. But there is a future, l'avenir, to come, which refers to someone who comes whose arrival is totally unexpected. For me, that is the real future, that which is totally unpredictable. The other who comes without my being able to anticipate their arrival. So if there is a real future beyond the other known future, it is l'avenir, in that it is the coming of the other when I am completely unable to foresee their arrival. And this is really one of my favorite quotes, because Now, I first heard this. There's an amazing documentary on Derrida's life. And of course, right now, I can't think of the title. And it's, you know, I have the DVD. But the way that the filmmaker used this quote as an overdub is while this thing is being said, we're just looking at footage of Derrida walking around, right? So in that sense that he also was the unforeseeable himself, you know, that continental philosophy could not imagine him 100 years before his arrival, that he had to arrive. So if you were to ask people about the future of philosophy, they would not have produced Jacques Derrida. And so that I like thinking a lot about the future of poetry. I am sure that some of the poems that we love and have committed to memory and that matter the most to us will matter in the future. Even as the, you know, planet implodes and, you know, whatever, because I think human nature just isn't that. Even though horrors are happening and marvels are happening, I just believe there's something fundamental that I can be moved by a Tang Dynasty poet, right? Or I could be moved by paintings on the walls of a cave in Lascaux, right? So that's not going to change. But what is interesting is what will come that we cannot imagine in relationship to poetry. And so to me, it's like a moot question. Like, so I'm cheating by pulling in the Derrida and just saying, I already really was a Mormon missionary. You know, I proselytized for 2 years. And I know I give tarot readings and people want to know about the future, right? So I've wasted my life and I'm already doing that shit. So I don't want to do that to you and make predictions about the future of poetry. So I want to cheat with Derrida and let it be this mysterious other that the three of us, even together, probably could not imagine.
Well, thank you, Tim, for leaving us with the other that we cannot anticipate. For those listeners whose economy is not, or whose attention is not totally destroyed by the digital information economy, who aren't taking care of their base material needs, where would you direct them to find your poetry or to find your work?
So if you want something for free, just go to timothylu.net, TOMOTHYLIU.net. And, you know, a shit ton of poems there. Or if you want to just get a book, you know, just go to Amazon or go to bookfinder.com and you can just type away. You can, if you like video entertainment, you can go to YouTube and do a little search and a bunch of readings that I've given in the last 10 years will pop up, you know. So those are some places to start.
Well, thank you so much for joining us at Green Space, Tim. And we hope this isn't our last conversation.
I want to thank both of you. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for the Procrustean bed of questions. It was torture, man. And but it has reformed me and has reshaped my mind, and I am always going to be grateful to you guys for that.
Okay, good. That's what we want. All right, I'm gonna